ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, First Canto, Chapter 8, Prayers by Queen Kunti, Text 34. Bharavataranayanye Bhuvo Nava Ivojato Sidantya Bhuriparena Jato Hyatma Bhuvartita. Translation. Others say that the world, being overburdened like a boat at sea, is much aggrieved, and that Brahma, who is your son, prayed for you, and so you have appeared to diminish the trouble. Purport. Brahma, or the first living being, born just after the creation, is the direct son of Narayan. Narayan, as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, first of all entered the material universe. Without spiritual contact, matter cannot create. This principle was followed from the very beginning of the creation. The Supreme Spirit entered the universe, and the first living being, Brahma, was born on a lotus flower grown out of the transcendental abdomen of Vishnu. Vishnu is therefore known as Padmanabha. Brahma is known as Atmabhu because he was begotten directly from the Father without any contact of Mother Lakshmiji. Lakshmiji was present near Narayan, engaged in the service of the Lord, and still, without contact with Lakshmiji, Narayan begot Brahma. That is the omnipotency of the Lord. One who foolishly considers Narayan like other living beings should take a lesson from this. Narayan is not an ordinary living being. He is the personality of Godhead himself, and he has all the potencies of all the senses in all parts of his transcendental body. An ordinary living being begets a child by sexual intercourse, and he has no other means to beget a child other than the one designed for him. But Narayan, being omnipotent, is not bound to any condition of energy. He is complete and independent to do anything and everything by his various potencies very easily and perfectly. Brahma is therefore directly the son of the Father and was not put into the womb of a mother. Therefore he is known as Atmabhu. This Brahma is in charge of further creations in the universe, secondarily reflected by the potency of the omnipotent. Within the halo of the universe, there is a transcendental planet known as Swetadvip, which is the abode of Chiradakshayi Vishnu, the Paramatma feature of the Supreme Lord. Whenever there is trouble in the universe that cannot be solved by the administrative demigods, they approach Brahmaji for a solution. And if it is not to be solved even by Brahmaji, then Brahmaji consults and prays to the Chiradakshayi Vishnu for an incarnation and solution to the problems. Such a problem arose when Kamsa and others were ruling over the earth, and the earth became too much overburdened by the misdeeds of the Asuras. Brahmaji, along with other demigods, prayed at the shore of the Shirodaka Ocean, and they were advised of the descent of Krishna as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki. So, Some people say that the Lord appeared because of the prayers of Brahmaji. Om Gyan Chimarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmaditam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namah. These prayers by Queen Kunti are a magnificent combination of head-felt and heartfelt expression. Some people think that bhakti is knowledge of the head. Other people say bhakti is the expression of the heart. But in Srimad Bhagavatam, and especially in these prayers that we're looking at, which Srila Prabhupada lectured upon so often, these prayers by Queen Kunti, we see the perfect combination of head and heart. And it is that perfect combination of head and heart that makes bhakti so attractive. Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting the most astounding, comprehensive knowledge available. And Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting the most profound, heart-stirring, pure emotions of the transcendental plane. In this way, our life is completely filled by the transcendental association of Srimad Bhagavatam, and that is as it should be, because the Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just as Krishna is perfect and complete, so Srimad Bhagavatam is perfect and complete. In this way, by associating with the prayers by Queen Kunti, our head and heart is completely satisfied. That is an impossible thing in the material world, in case you haven't noticed. How many births and deaths does it take in this world for us to understand that our heads and hearts will never be properly satisfied by interaction with the material energy? Will we learn this just by experience? It's very doubtful. Only if we submissively give our ears to the transcendental sound vibration coming from authorized sources can we see through the bewilderment caused by Maya. We don't have a fair chance to understand things in this world separate from Krishna. But the illusory energy of the Lord presents itself. You have a fair chance to understanding. It's a level playing field. There's equal opportunity. Just apply your senses, apply your intelligence, and knowledge will be available to you. This is the proposition made to us by the material energy. All you have to do is endeavor in the right way. All you have to do is learn the right material things, and there'll be heart and head fulfillment for you in this lifetime. This is the hypocrisy that's presented to us, and we can only blame ourselves because we desire to cohabit with this hypocrisy. And then we have to experience the results. Karanam gunasangasya sadasa yoni janmasu. By associating with material nature, we experience different varieties of happiness and distress which have nothing to do with our real situation. But we think, oh, this has everything to do with me. Just look at this happiness. Just look at this distress. It's all me. In this way, we undergo the miseries of material existence, marching onward, fueled by our false pride. It's very important to understand what is fueling our material existence, what's driving the engine of the perpetuation of our repeated birth and death. Material desire means lust combined with pride. There is a hankering, there is a longing, there is a yearning. But that's not all. There is the pride. I can do it. I'll be successful in some way. Now, often we present ourselves to ourselves as being very rational and practical. I don't expect to achieve and succeed in every circumstance. Now, I'm aware of how life works, but I do expect that I will get my share of heartfelt and headfelt satisfaction. There'll be some bad times, of course. I'm not sentimental. I understand how this world works. There'll be some bad times. There'll be a few problems, some health problems, some relationship problems. There'll be maybe some economic anxieties. There'll be a few world wars, but still, I'll in some way be satisfied. I expect that. And then, when I finally give up my body in peace, I'll have the satisfaction of knowing that I lived a life that was worthwhile. And how will I die? I have no idea what my next life will be, but it doesn't matter. I will just die peacefully in my sleep, and that'll be the end. Statistics show that almost everyone hopes that they will die peacefully in their sleep. But actually, in developed countries, only 1 out of 10 persons die peacefully in their sleep. But this is everyone's dream ending. A life of head and heart fulfillment. I missed a few problems, which I'll handle easily with the help of my friends and relatives. And then I'll expire gracefully while sleeping in bed, and that'll be the end. And if there is a hereafter, I'm sure that because I'm a good person in my own way, that good hereafter will be for me. Therefore, statistics also show that 80% of the American public think they're going to heaven after death. It is natural when you're in contact with the illusory energy to think like that. You become inspired with desire and pride. I do have some value. I do have some good things about me. Sometimes people protest. Krishna consciousness is very self-effacing. It's very, repressive of positive ego expression. We're always singing songs like, Gurudev, I have no good qualities. Your mercy is all I'm made of. We're chanting shlokas, be more tolerant than a blade, tolerant than a tree. Think of yourself more fallen and lowly than a blade of grass. So psychologists present that this is not very healthy for a proper lifestyle. In other words, from the materialistic point of view, to live a proper material lifestyle, it's good to have pride. I can do it. Just give me the right opportunities. It shall be done. This false vision of how the material world works is part of the bewildering charms of Maya. When will we understand that we are not being given a fair chance by Maya to understand anything? Everything is rigged against a fair chance. But somehow or other, we feel so inspired with our senses, with our intelligence. Yes, I see exactly what's going on. Yes, I am aware of opportunities for my own pleasure. Let life go on in this way. Now, all of you can understand that there is such a thing as desire. What is the trap of material desire? Often we think that it's quite an innocent thing to have material desires. After all, we're in the material world. We have a material body. So, you know, material desires, just go along with it. Just don't let those material desires get too much. And what is too much material desires? What the other person has. That's too much. I have the correct blend. I have the properly balanced allotment of material desires, but those other people who are causing all the wars, They are too much. They are the materialists. I simply aspire for my quota of what I need, and if Krishna is intelligent, he'll allot me my quota of material satisfaction, knowing that if I satisfy my material desires, I'll be a more cooperative bhakta. Krishna should understand that. If he's interested in me going back to Godhead, if Krishna is interested in world peace, then he should allow that material desires are fulfilled peacefully and successfully, and then people will be more interested in taking up Krishna consciousness. Now, it is true that in bhakti yoga, we do not put persons into crash courses of supposedly renouncing everything. Krishna is the most expert physician, and he knows how to arrange our life for us to gradually come to our senses. At the same time, we have to understand it is impossible to satisfy material desires. This is a little bit paradoxical, because it seems since I have the desires, they should be satisfied to some extent, because I have them. You see? Because I have them, there should be some satisfaction, because I have them. It doesn't work like that. What happens is, we have the material desires, and the fact is, the desires will not be satisfied, therefore we take another birth, bringing our desires into that birth, and once again, those desires cannot be satisfied, so we take another birth, and this way, the cycle of repeated birth and death is perpetuated by material desire, because inherently, material desires can't be satisfied. Now, what to do? Is our life hopeless? Unless we relinquish the world completely, we can't have anything to do with Krishna. Kunti Devi, she's praying in her prayers that the Lord is the property of the materially impoverished. That, she says, Namo Kinchana Vittaya Nivritta Guna Vrittaye Atmaramaya Shantaya Kaivaya Pataye Namaha. My obeisances are unto you, who are the property of the materially impoverished. And of course, she also says in the preceding verse, Janmaishvaya Shruta Shribhir Edamana Madha Puman Naivaha Jabidhatun Bhai Tvama Kinchana Gotram. My Lord, your lordship can easily be approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. So this is what we're after in bhakti yoga, approaching Krishna with sincere feeling. And that approach requires the proper blend of head and heart. We have to know what we are doing, and we have to know how to feel. This is the glory of the bhakti marg. All the things that we want, all our aspirations, can be satisfied in the approach to Lord Krishna. Krishna is the most expert physician. He knows how to arrange our life so that gradually we get over our disease. We have to get the culprit in our vision, what's causing the trouble. And then gradually we can deal with the problem. It's a hard pill to swallow at first. It seems quite natural to have material desires, and because we have them, as we said before, because we have them, it seems they should be fulfilled. But finally, we learn it is not possible. Now what? Should our hearts be filled with despair? I have desires that can't be fulfilled. Oh, this is crazy. No. Once we learn how to desire Krishna's pleasure, then a whole new world of desire opens up to us. And everyone likes to desire. Frustrated by material desires, some people take to impersonalism. And in this way think, the solution is to get rid of all individuality and all desire. But bhakti yoga gets us to relinquish our puny material desires caused by the bewilderment of Maya and gets us to enter the fascinating, unlimited world of desiring Krishna's pleasure. But in the beginning, we're a little, well, not only in the beginning, in the middle too, we're a little uneasy that, is it going to be sure? Jai, Sri Sri Gaurantai, Sri Sri Krishna Balaram, Sri Sri Radha Yashama. In the beginning, we're a little unsure. Will I be compensated properly by Krishna for my great charitable act of divesting myself of a few material desires? Will I be compensated properly? Is Krishna really on the level? Is Krishna really aware of how I'll have a hole in my heart that's going to need to be filled if I give up my dear longings that cause repeated birth and death? There'll be a gap. There'll be a hole. Will Krishna fill it? Is Krishna able to fulfill it? By our hearing the prayers by Queen Kunti, we get confidence because we see that Queen Kunti has no doubt that every aspect of her life is fulfilled by being in the association of the Supreme Lord. Her concern is, now that the battle of Kurukshetra is over, Krishna's leaving. Krishna solved so many problems. Now, he's going. So Kunti Devi has to present a situation to get Krishna to stay. She says, first of all, let's understand what actually happened in the battle of Kurukshetra. Krishna promised Kunti Devi that her 5 sons would return from the battle. And that promise of the Lord to Kunti Devi is given as an example in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu for the truthfulness of the Lord. He promised, and the 5 sons came back. Kunti Devi is going to point out the return of my sons, the success of the Pandavas in the battle of Kurukshetra was all due to Krishna. So she's going to tell him, you executed all the duties yourself. In other words, don't make it like we did anything significant. You did it all yourself. Because of your grace, things worked out. Now, how can you go? Don't think that because the battle of Kurukshetra ended, everything is going to be fine. In this way, Kunti Devi was desperately looking for reasons to point out to Krishna right now why he had to stay. She said, just look, all the inimical kings are dead, but their sons and grandsons are still alive. Therefore, there's still going to be problems, therefore still you can't go. This is how her heart's feelings are causing such a wonderful exposition of transcendental knowledge. She didn't want Krishna to go, so she's looking around how to present reality to convince Krishna. Everything's not all right. You still can't go. And then she said, Kevayam namarupabhyam yarubhi sahapandava. Just like the name and fame of the body is finished when the spirit soul goes, similarly, our name and fame, our activities, in fact, even the Pandavas and Yadus, the dynasties themselves will be finished if you go. So she's presenting her case in a very powerful way. Krishna, you cannot leave now. Mm. Next, she presents the beauty of nature. Just see any beauty that we see in the world around us, any natural attractions that are present in this world, are only there because your lotus feet are walking on the earth. If you withdraw your lotus feet from touching the earth, all natural beauties fade away. What about economic prosperity? All the villages, all the cities, all the pasturing grounds are prospering. The economy is going on nicely only because of your glance. So in this way, Kunti Devi's heartfelt emotions are causing such an exposition of transcendental knowledge. She exists in parental love of Krishna. Unlike Yashoda Devi, Kunti Devi is aware of the omnipotency of the Supreme Lord. On the list given in Nectar of Devotion, you remember, Kunti Devi is between Devaki and the other wives of Vasudev and Vasudev himself in terms of intimacy with Krishna in parental love. Although Krishna, in the beginning of this chapter, has offered his obeisances to Kunti Devi, his aunt, she's completely aware he's more than just my nephew. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, she's giving us reasons why Krishna appears. First of all, she establishes that Krishna comes, just as the Lord does in Bhagavad Gita. Ajopi san avyatma, bhutanam ishvaropi san, prakatim swamajishtaya, sambhavamyatmamayaya. Krishna explains, okay, you understand that I'm unborn. You understand my body never deteriorates. You understand I'm the Lord of all living entities. But what is the further conclusion? I can still come to the material world, and in no way will my super excellent qualities and activities be diminished. This is a very important point, because many people in the world loosely consider themselves to be theists. Yes, yes, we believe in God. It's too much to accept that this world came about by chance from nothing. Yeah, we believe there's a God. But they have no idea how the Supreme Lord can come to this world or why he would want to come to this world. Therefore, they live a godless life while believing in God. Yes, there's a God somewhere. Yes, there is a creator. Yes, there is a maintainer. And then they proceed to live life just as everyone else, whether theist or atheist, because they have no idea of how the Supreme Lord can come to this world or why he should want to come to this world. They can't conceive of it. There's a God, and he is perfect, and this world is imperfect, so therefore the two never meet. But Krishna doesn't say that in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, yes, I'm Aja, I'm born. Yes, my body is avyaya, inexhaustible. Yes, I'm the Ishvar of all the living entities, but still I come. Now, what is the mechanism by which Krishna comes? Sambhavami Atma Maya. I come by my own Maya. I come my own way. Now, how many of us can say we came to this world our own way? We cannot say that. We were forced by the material energy to take birth in one of several ways. In a womb, as a seed, as an egg, or the Bhagavatam says you can also take birth through perspiration. So, take your pick. You cannot say, sambhavami atma maya. You did not come your way. You were forced by a mechanism external to you. But for Krishna, yes, sambhavami atma maya, he comes his own way through his own personal energy. No maya outside of Krishna causes him to appear or arranges his appearance in this world. So that's the first thing Krishna wants us to understand. He can come to this world without incurring any problems. He can display his activities without any disturbance, without any reduction in his pleasure or potency. All this can be done. Now, what's the next question? Okay, if Krishna can come, why would he want to come here? And the Lord explains that in Bhagavad Gita also. Three reasons. Puritranaya sarunam vanashaya jadushkata. Dharma samstapanataya. In order to deliver the sadhus, just like Queen Kunti said, some people say you came because of Vasudeva and Devaki. They prayed for you to come as their son, and then they got into great difficulty because you were appearing as their son. So some people say you came to deliver them. Pritranaya sadhana. Krishna also says, I come to annihilate the miscreants. So Queen Kunti also echoes that reason. You came to finish off the enemies of Vasudeva and Devaki. And in this verse she says, because the world is overburdened, therefore, you've come to diminish the trouble. Now what does it mean to diminish the trouble? It means to get rid of the demons. Because of demoniac understanding, there's trouble. So when Kunti Devi says, so you have appeared to diminish the trouble, she's meaning you have appeared to get rid of the demons. So Krishna agrees. He has said that in Bhagavad Gita. I come in order to annihilate the miscreants and to reestablish what is Dharma. Queen Kunti will also say that later. Others, their opinion is that you come to rejuvenate the processes of devotional service, hearing, chanting, remembering, and so on. So in this way, Kunti Devi echoes Bhagavad Gita and presents all the different reasons why Krishna appears. And they're all true. Ultimately, everything is for Krishna's pleasure in terms of his appearance. Whatever he does, the ultimate reason is his own blissfulness. He is all attractive. That means even the demons are attracted to him. This is a little bit difficult to understand, but it's an important point. If we're going to see how it is that ultimately Krishna is appearing just for his own pleasure, if we're going to be able to understand how the Lord is all attractive, then we have to see that he's even attractive to his so-called enemies, to the demons. How can that be? When the demons are attracted to kill Krishna, that is showing that indeed the Lord is attracting them. They're thinking, we must kill Krishna, we must kill Krishna. Just like Kamsa. Day and night, I have to kill Krishna even though he can't be killed. Vishnu is coming, he's going to kill me, I must kill him even though he can't be killed. This is attraction. We're used to thinking of attraction in the positive way. Admiring the wonderful beauty of the Lord. Just like Kunti is going to pray, may my attraction ever flow to you, just like the Ganges is flowing toward the sea. We can understand that easily. But also, those who oppose Krishna, they're also attracted. They're thinking of Krishna so intensely that in the seventh canto of Bhagavatam, no one else than Narada Muni prays, oh, if I was only intensely attracted to Krishna as the great demons are. If my love for Krishna was only as intense as the demons hate Krishna, then my spiritual life would be successful. His verse shows you how devotees can appreciate everyone for something in relation to Krishna and Krishna's service. So, Krishna is indeed all attractive because even his enemies are attracted to him. Now, this topic of the world being burdened, overburdened like a boat at sea, is very appropriate for today's context. What is causing the difficulty in the world today? Many people are bewildered. Why can't there just be peaceful sense gratification? That's the great hope of the developed world, the first world. Why can't the third world and the developing countries just understand that all they need are free markets and the ballot box, and then peace and happiness will naturally flow? This has been the great contribution to the world from the 20th century thinkers. Once there are free markets everywhere, once there is democracy everywhere, then people's natural aspirations will flow, they'll be satisfied, and the world will be a stable and fulfilling place. This dream has spread everywhere, but it's not to be. The Bhagavatam explains very clearly that as long as there is the propagation of uncontrolled sense gratification, there can never be peace. Now, it's not that we want to immediately stamp out all sense gratification. God forbid. Krishna has a system for how we can gradually get over our neuroses. Krishna has a method for us to gradually regain our spiritual health. That methodology includes a civilization in which people can understand the need for truthfulness, austerity, compassion, sacrifice, living according to the Shastra, understanding the role of the cows, the brahmanas, like that. That is Krishna's gradual way for us to get over our disease. But what is happening today is that all the elements of traditional culture of happiness for human beings, they're all being destroyed, just as Kamsa's advisors wanted it. For human beings to be properly situated in this world so that they can have some hope of fulfillment, you need a decent social foundation, which includes elements of sense control, discipline, truthfulness, and so forth. Guidance from spiritually wise persons, honoring the cows, but that is all destroyed today. Yet people still expect there'll be world peace, there'll be individual peace, and it's not happening. Remember that in this purport at the end it's mentioned how Kamsa and his associates caused such a burden to the world that even Brahma couldn't solve it. The demigods approached Brahma, and he didn't know what to do. In rare occasions like that, he goes to approach the Lord on Swetadweep, and from the shore of the ocean of milk, he offers prayers and hears the Lord's answer in his heart. This is how great havoc Kamsa and his associates caused. You remember, after Krishna was transferred to Vrindavan, and the daughter of Yashoda, Yogamaya, was transferred to Mathura, to the prison cell, then Kamsa rushed into the prison cell. He had been alerted, the eighth child is born. So he came rushing in. My death has appeared, I'll kill my death before it kills me. So, you know, we were discussing in Mayapur how Devaki, even though it wasn't her child, still she's increasing her devotional service by trying to save someone else's child. Actually, it's Yashoda's child. Devaki knows Krishna is safe, but she's going to increase her devotional service beyond bringing into the world the Supreme Lord. Now she's going to save someone else's child, and she's trying. So she's appealing to Kamsa, begging piteously, crying, don't kill this baby girl, Kamsa. Don't kill her. She reprimands him. Don't you remember you already killed so many of my babies? And then she offers him a gift because she's a clever Kshatriya girl, so she knows how to make politics. You killed so many of my children, but also I'll give you a gift. I'll give you this girl to be the daughter, to be the wife of your son. In this way, she appealed to Kamsa from various angles. Kamsa wouldn't hear it. He grabbed the newborn baby by the legs and prepared to smash her head against the wall. Then, of course, you know what happened. The baby appeared as Durga, and Kamsa immediately offered his full obeisances. He was overwhelmed. Devaki, I never knew that you were of such high stature. Now upon seeing Durga Devi, as your child, I can understand your greatness. Previously, I thought you were just trying to give birth to Krishna. Of course, I had to kill you. I tried to kill you before, and certainly I was going to kill Krishna. But now, lo and behold, it's Durga Devi who has appeared from you. My whole vision of you has changed. I never knew you were so saintly. That is the vision of Kamsa being fascinated by the material energy. So then he goes through a whole forgiveness scene. And he actually speaks knowledge. You know, I killed so many of your children. It was all by destiny. I was simply the immediate cause, but we all know that the blame lies with the remote cause. Destiny has its way. The bodies, they come and go. So, please, do not hold it against me so much that I did this, killing six of your children and trying to kill the eighth. Don't hold it against me. Then Kamsa falls at the feet of Vasudeva also, and begs for mercy, emotionally, besides making his philosophical presentation. Now, what is Vasudeva and Devaki's response? It's very interesting. They were generally impressed by Kamsa's exposition of transcendental knowledge. And Prabhupada explains, actually, Kamsa was showing a little bit of grace from the Lord by being able to speak such knowledge about temporary material conditions and temporary bodies and immediate cause, remote cause. So, Vasudeva and Devaki complimented him. Yes, yes, you have spoken properly. Destiny has its way. What can be done? And they genuinely forgave Kamsa. How can that be? If someone had just killed six of your children and was about to kill another, you would forgive them? But this is all the arrangement of Yoga Maya. That Kamsa's momentarily come to his senses, overwhelmed by Mahamaya, and that Vasudeva and Devaki, they easily forgave him. But still, Vasudeva and Devaki had another motive. They generally appreciated the exposition of transcendental knowledge coming from Kamsa, but also they knew, anyway, Krishna's already born, and he's going to kill you, so we'll forgive you. Go on speaking like that. Yes, yes, all glories, yes. It's all destiny. It's true, it's all destiny. The eighth child was predicted to kill you. It's still going to happen, so let me forgive you. Yes, you've spoken so nicely. So Kamsa goes back to his cronies to report to them what happened, and they don't like it. So all of Kamsa's spiritual advancements that he made in those few moments, overawed by Durga Devi, they go down the drain in bad association. This is a great lesson, that you can have your breakthroughs, as the New Agers like to say. You can have your peak moments of life, peak realizations, deep insights, but in bad association, everything can be ruined. So this is what happened to Kamsa. He presented to his cronies how everything is going to be all right now. I've asked forgiveness of Vasudeva and Devaki. Why should I try to kill Devaki's child? the child's been born elsewhere. It's a fact. How do I know it's a fact? Durga Devi told me. In this way, Kamsa becomes completely cheated by the external energy. That's the way it is, as we were speaking earlier. We think that there's a hope for us to be satisfied in contact with the material energy. That hope is never to be achieved, and therefore, one birth after another goes by as our unfulfilled material desires lead to another body. So, Kamsa had that conviction. Durga Devi has told us the child's born elsewhere. This is complete cheating. But that's what goes on by the grace of the material energy. Simply cheating. But we don't expect that. We expect a fair go. We expect a level playing field. We expect equal opportunity from the material energy, not about to happen. So, Kamsa's advisors, his friends, they didn't like the way things were going. And they began to remind Kamsa of his glories. Don't you know? Because of you, the demigods are always afraid. Because of you, they flee on the battlefield. Because of you, they beg for mercy. Don't kill us. Don't kill us. You have nothing to fear from them. In fact, because they are so much against you, we must make a plan to kill them now. Finish off the disease before it becomes too great. Remove the tumor before it consumes the whole body. The best thing is to look around and kill any child that's been born in the whole area. Don't worry about retaliation. Who can stack up against you? Who is so mighty to dare oppose you? Even the greatest demigods can't handle you. Why should you worry about Vishnu? He's trapped in everyone's heart and can't come out. Why should you worry about Shiva? He's off in the forest performing austerities. Why should you worry about Brahma? He's lost somewhere deep in meditation. Nothing will stop our plan. And what are we going to do? We're going to destroy all the elements of human society that allow Vishnu worship to go on, directly or indirectly. Sometimes devotees have debates. Shall we preach directly? Should we preach indirectly? So often I like to say, why get hung up about that? Why not do both? Adopt all methods how to reach people with Krishna consciousness, whether it's direct or indirect, understanding that we'd love to give everyone hearing and chanting about Krishna directly, but also we understand that unless society is a sane place, it's very difficult for people to concentrate on the transcendental message of the Lord. Now just look at the strategies of the demons. They had no qualms about direct and indirect methods. They were going to do both. We're going to kill all the children. That way we'll probably get Vishnu in our net. And we're also going to kill all elements of society that produce a favorable or fertile soil for Vishnu worship. That's the indirect method. In this way, they made a plan how to make life horrible, and come to agree, and so this is how Krishna Lila was going to proceed. So this is overburdening the earth. We think, well, that was back then, and those demons were very special. They could change their form into anything they liked. Kamarupa, the modern people studying alien phenomena, they call it shape-shifting. All their reports of aliens say that the aliens, the extraterrestrials, they can change into any form they like. So Bhagavatam calls it Kamarupa. Kamsa's friends were like that, and they took advantage of this mystical ability to cause havoc. All right. How is the world today being overburdened? You have the same thing going on. The traditional elements of a progressive human society have been destroyed. No one knows anything anymore about sense control, truthfulness, honesty, cleanliness, mercy, discipline. No one is respecting cows. No one is honoring Brahminical culture. Yet, people are thinking there should be world peace. This is a great illusion. When you think how much money is spent on military budgets, it is astounding. Whenever something starts in the Persian Gulf, regardless of going in the dealing with the relative rights or wrongs of the situation, think of the expense. Generally, when some action starts in the Persian Gulf against Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, they show on TV the cruise missiles firing from the battleships into the areas under attack. And depending on which country you're from, you may feel some patriotic pride. Look at those cruise missiles shooting out from the battleships onto the attack land. Or you may feel that, how much is this costing? Do you know how much one cruise missile costs? Just one cruise missile. $1 million. Just one. How much do the fighter bombers cost in the U.S. Air Force? Just one fighter bomber? Often, we're scratching our heads how to finance the Krishna Conscious Movement, how to get the necessary funds for countering attacks, how one day to build the Mayapur Project. We're scratching our heads over comparatively a little bit of money. One fighter bomber, not the big intercontinental bombers, but one fighter bomber. $33 million. How about the tanks? They're very important in roaring over the desert in the Middle East. Have to have tanks. One tank, just one tank in the U.S. arsenal. $10 million, one tank. All we say is, at least give us the money that you would have spent on one cruise missile, just $1 million. Maybe a tank? You give us the money instead? You know, instead of building one tank. Just one less tank. Give us the $10 million. One less fighter bomber? $33 million? This is overburdening the world. It doesn't work. It is an enormous misuse of human energy. Then you have the total lack of a culture of sense control. I was speaking in Mumbai about the topic frustrated love, the distortion of satisfaction. So Star TV and other media, they were immediately interested. Oh, this is a very nice theme for India. So many people are interested now in this topic. So many people realize that they should throw off the shackles of traditional relationships and traditional ways of man and woman relating to one another, and everyone should be interested simply how you get fulfillment of desire. So I pointed out that because in India, the reason why there is sense control and discipline has been forgotten. Therefore, in the cities, people are thinking, why not do just like Hollywood and Bollywood say? What we see on the movie screen, just complete lack of sense control, obviously that's the happy way. Why should we have restraint? Why should we inhibit ourselves with these old traditions, old cultural methods of family stability, restraint, sense control? Why should that be there? No one knows the reason anymore because they've forgotten Krishna. The whole purpose of having a stable human society, the whole purpose of having stable families, controlled relationships between men and women, the whole purpose is to make the human mind peaceful so that we can understand what is Krishna. But the goal is forgotten. Vedaishta Sarvaya, Ahameva Veja. Krishna says, by all the Vedas I am to be known. That means that by Vedic culture, Krishna is meant to be known. You take Krishna away from the culture, You take Krishna away from the remnants of Vedic culture that exists in India today, and then after a while, no one can remember. Why are we doing these things? Why are we controlling ourselves, having only one wife, having family responsibility, doing everything in a very methodical, patient fashion? Why are we doing that? Look at what's on the movie screen. Look at what Hollywood is telling us. Look at what Bollywood is telling us. That's the way to go. Uninhibited sensual desires. Instant gratification. That is progress. That is advancement. So I explained that this is what's going on. The traditional elements of human happiness, a culture of human, the traditional elements of the culture for human happiness are being exterminated. It's already gone in the West. Now it's under attack in India. And therefore, you're going to see a lot of frustration instead of a lot of happiness from sense gratification. So the reporters, they were interested, and they had a whole line of camera persons and journalists. They went through the whole, they went through a section of the guests at the Chaupati Temple asking, are you frustrated in love? Are you frustrated in love? We explained to them that It's not that people simply come to Krishna consciousness because they're frustrated in love or because they've experienced material setbacks. Some people do come because of knowledge. And there's no doubt the knowledge of Bhagavatam far surpasses any human attempt at knowledge. Therefore, once again, in closing, I would like to point out these prayers by Queen Kunti, they unite the head and the heart in the most extraordinary fashion. They provide the deepest fulfillment because nothing is left out. There's emotion, there's metaphysical knowledge, there's understanding of Krishna, there's understanding of living entity, there's attraction, there's also the beginnings of love in separation, which are more dramatically demonstrated by the gopis. But Kunti is also feeling her separation. When Krishna is away from Dwarka, the residents there are also feeling separation. Of course, nothing matches the separation felt by the residents of Vrindavan. Still, the first canto is preparing you emotionally and with knowledge so that you can appreciate the Leelas of the 10th canto. So first, we're presented with Kunti Devi's feelings that Krishna's about to leave. How can we stop him from going? Yudhisthira will get the job done for a few days. Yudhisthira is going to say, after Kunti's prayers are over, Yudhisthira is going to say, my dear Krishna, won't you stay a few days longer? And Krishna will agree. Are there any questions? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. Jaya Shivam Sabadaj Vitaya Sumati Sivakti Vedanta Samiraj Prabhupada Jaya Mishkabam Sabadaj Vitaya Sumati Sivakti Vedanta Samiraj Prabhupada Gaur Premanandi.